I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Pennsylvania legislature voted on Wednesday to postpone the primary from April 28th to June 2nd because of the threat of the coronavirus pandemic. A few months ago, the legislature approved mail-in ballots and other election reforms. Part of the $2.2 trillion rescue package being voted on today by the House of Representatives includes $400 million to the states for election assistance. Joining us is Kathy Buchvar, and she's Secretary of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, to talk about election readiness. And Kathy Buchvar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
When is the governor going to sign this bill to postpone the election? Do you know?
I do, this morning, probably around 11:30 or so.
And is there anything specific in the bill that we should know about besides the fact that the primary is going to be postponed?
Yes. Actually, this is a great bill, and I'm really thrilled that the legislature took it so seriously and really streamlined it. This bill has, and it was a completely unanimous bipartisan effort. So the bill offers a lot. So we all very much supported moving the primary to keep the balance tipped in favor of public health, make sure that our poll workers and election officials who need to be preparing now for the election, keep them safe, as well as the voters, while also balancing access to voting. But in addition, the bill allows eases sort of restrictions on polling places. So it allows election officials to better plan for the election now on June 2nd. And it also makes it easier to canvass the absentee and mail-in ballots, which now any voter in Pennsylvania can apply for mail-in ballots for any reason or no reason at all. And I highly encourage voters to do so and would love to talk about this some more.
Well, absolutely. Let me just ask you another just question related to postponement. If for some reason the state of Pennsylvania is in lockdown come June 2nd, can the primary be postponed again? And I'm assuming the outlying date is whenever the Democratic convention is going to be, or the Republican convention is going to be.
Yes. I mean, obviously, we are monitoring this day by day. We all know that we are in uncharted waters here, and changes had to be made quickly. Nobody wants to be in the position that Ohio was in, deciding the day before, the night before the election, to call it off. So thank goodness for, you know, Governor Wolf and the legislative leadership here preparing well in advance. And we will continue to monitor it. And thanks to Act 77, which was passed in the fall, because any voter can vote by mail, that makes it much easier for us. So, for example, you know, I'm co-chair of the Elections Committee of the National Association of Secretaries of State, and we've been having weekly calls with secretaries of state across the country to compare notes, share, you know, resources, help each other in every way we can. And the states that didn't have excuse-free mail-in voting, it added a whole other layer here where they had to, you know, enact legislative change or other ways to make sure that every voter could vote by mail. So we're ahead of the game here in Pennsylvania. We'll continue to prepare ahead of time.
Well, let's talk about vote by mail, because it seems like that will be an option that a lot of people will want to know about and probably use. How do they get a mail-in ballot?
So the easiest way to do it is online. So last year, we created an online application. Then it was just for absentee ballots. But when Act 77 was passed in the fall, we added it for mail-in ballots. So go to votespa.com. It's really simple, very straightforward. You enter your information. It walks you through the process. And the advantage of doing it online, in addition to the ease of it, and you could do it 24/7 from your bed or kitchen, is if you enter your email address, we have notifications that will automatically come to you when your application is received, when your application is approved, when your ballot is mailed to you, and when your ballot is received by the county. So it takes away the guessing, the wondering about your timing with the mail. It's very, very straightforward. And almost 80% of applications are coming in online, which is amazing. Wow.
I'm wondering about those people that you know, frankly, don't have access to a computer. Is there a more sort of analog option for those potential voters?
Yes. So you can still apply by printing on a piece of paper that has the paper application, or you could go to your county election office and do it in person. Just call your county election office first, because they may be shut down due to the COVID emergency as well, or they may have skeletal crews coming in at certain hours. So I recommend call your county election office before showing up. And, yeah, the paper, or either hand-delivering by paper or mailing, are still completely, you know, available options. And the other thing that I want to point out that Act 77 provided, and again, call your county election office before you show up because of the crisis right now.
Sure.
But one of the options that Act 77 provided is in-person mail-in voting. And so once this passes and the offices are open and the ballots are finalized, which should be in the coming weeks, you can go in person to your county election office, submit your ask for an application as you're there, fill it out while you're there, submit it, and they'll hand you a ballot while you're in the office. You can complete it there, and you could cast your ballot all in one visit. And in fact, the change that just was made this week, that's going to be signed into law this morning, even if you're not registered, you can go to your county election office, register to vote, ask for a mail-in ballot application, and cast your ballot all in one day. Mm. So it's a great accessible option for voters once the election offices are all back open and running.
I was going to say, once this lockdown is over with.
Correct.
How quickly, and with a mail-in ballot, how are they counted? Is there a machine that uses it, or how are all those votes counted?
So they're counted by the county election office. So in most places historically, absentee ballots have been counted in the polling places by the poll workers on election night. That switched from Act 77. So Act 77 provided for central counting, which in Philly has been going on for some years. And so basically, when they're submitted to the county election office, which, by the way, Act 77 extended the date for submitting your ballot, so you can cast your ballot all the way up to 8 p.m. on election night to your county election office. And then they're counted, they're checked for eligibility. The signature check on the back of the envelope is done by the county election offices. There's an opportunity for the parties and the candidates to challenge ballots should there be a question as to a voter's eligibility. And then they'll be scanned like the paper ballots used on election day. So just through different centrally located machines.
So just to make sure our listeners understand, so the deadline for mail-in or absentee ballot is essentially election day?
Correct. So you could, but I highly recommend, if you're using the mail, don't wait. If you're using the mail, mail it a week ahead of time. You don't want to, it has to be received by 8 p.m. on election night. So if you're cutting it close, drive to the election office and hand deliver it so that you can ensure that your ballot is counted.
Now, Pennsylvania has new voting machines. Are they ready to go? Have they been tested, and are they ready to go?
They are. So all 67 counties selected new voting systems, and 45 of the 67 counties rolled them out last year, of which Philadelphia was one of them, and Montgomery County also did last year. Bucks is using theirs for the first time, although they used them in the special election last month.
Right.
Or is that this month? I guess that was still this month.
I think it was this month, yes. Right. I know. Losing track of time.
Every week. Yeah. Every week feels a bit like an eternity these days. But yes. Yeah, so the Collier counties, Delaware County and Bucks County, I think, are both using them for the first time, but the other counties use them before that. And all the counties have been preparing, again, with the COVID emergency declaration and stay at home. We've been encouraging all the election officials to stay home, protect themselves, protect their families. So once these lift, they'll go back to poll worker trainings and all the testing of the machines that they've been doing for weeks already. And yeah, everybody's ready to go.
I think anyone that goes to the polls sees that poll workers often skew older. They seem like they're retirees or certainly people in their 60s, 70s, maybe even older. And we are learning that these are an at-risk population because of coronavirus. Are there any thoughts to sort of rethink who should be at the polls, even if we get on the other side of this pandemic?
Yeah. Well, and that's part of why we thought it was so important in the legislation that was passed this week to make changes not only to the date of the primary, but also changes to the polling places and the poll workers to ease restrictions. So one of the things that the bill provides for is it allows the counties to do consolidation of polling places so that there's fewer, because as you know, schools are are closed and senior centers are contain more vulnerabilities and more vulnerable populations. So there's been challenges for counties in maintaining the polling places that they already had. And then poll workers as well are protecting themselves as they should be, like everybody else. And so the bill provides for easier, more options for polling places, easier consolidation, but also to be able to recruit poll workers from other districts. So temporarily. So currently under the old Pennsylvania law that applies except for this primary, poll workers had to live in the district where the polling place covered. For the purpose of this primary, counties can go outside of that district to find poll workers. Department of State has also been working with business organizations and other entities to try to recruit poll workers from other sources, as well as schools. Students who are, even students who can't vote, who are 17, can be poll workers with the consent of their parents and the principal. And if they're in good standing. Yeah, so that's a great source.
I'm watching the clock here. The House of Representatives voting on this $2 trillion package, but part of it is something like $400 million to go to the states for election assistance. Assume it passes and assume Pennsylvania gets, let's say, $20 million. Where would you want to spend that money?
So Pennsylvania is likely to get closer to around $14 million based on sort of past calculations. And what it looks like the restrictions or guidance are going to be for involve basically manners of voting that allow protection of the public health. So things like increasing the ability to vote by mail, expand early voting, online options, and safety of in-person voting. So,
I gave you no time to answer that question, but I do appreciate. Kathy Buchvar, she's Secretary of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, talking about the fact that this morning Governor Wolf is going to make it official. Primary day will be June 2nd. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Even under the best of circumstances, there have been serious problems with our electoral system, dysfunctional voting machines, voter roll purges, onerous ID laws. The looming threat today is coronavirus that has forced millions of people to stay home and avoid contact with others. States are delaying primaries, hoping the worst of the pandemic will pass in the next few months. And while many states have vote by mail options, some do not. There are also concerns about poll workers, many of whom are elderly, and the urgency to make sure that the primary and general elections are fair and correct and transparent. We have two guests who have joined us. Rick Hassan is a professor of law and political science at the University of California at Irvine. He's an election blogger and the author of a new book called Election Meltdown: Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Rick Hassan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
Also with us is Gloria Brown Marshall, and she's a professor of constitutional law at John Jay College. She's the author of a book called The Voting Rights War, the NAACP, and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice. And Gloria Brown Marshall, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Well, let me begin with a kind of a broad-based question. And Rick, I will start with you. Can our system withstand a viral attack? And by system, I mean our electoral system.
Well, I think the first thing to note is that we don't have a single election for president. We actually have something like 9,000 or 10,000 different elections because we're so decentralized. We don't know what things are going to look like in November. It's certainly possible that there will at least be pockets of places where people will not be able to go out to polling places. And so I am very concerned about whether we can pull off a successful election in enough places that people will accept the results as legitimate.
I mean, Gloria, we have voted through civil wars and other wars and other hard times. Do you share Rick's concern about 2020?
I share the concern, but I also know we voted and had campaigning during the Spanish flu, which was the worst pandemic in history that we compared to the bubonic plague as the other one. There are going to be hardships and there are going to be difficulties that were born of the restrictions that were put in place when the Voting Rights Act was gutted. And so it's going to be those restrictions on steroids. And I agree with him that there are going to be people who will not be satisfied with the outcome.
And that is worrisome, and I do want to get to that. Rick, we were talking about, I was talking with the Pennsylvania Commonwealth Secretary about the fact that Pennsylvania is going to delay the primary on to June 2nd. Other states have done as well. Does that seem like a good thing to do under the circumstances?
Well, moving a primary is much less serious than moving the general election, which is not really possible for president. I think, you know, what we saw a few weeks ago when Ohio, Illinois, Arizona, and Florida had primaries was that it was a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. Ohio at the last minute and potentially in violation of the state's own law canceled the primary, moved it to later. They went ahead in the other states, but there were many problems. Poll workers, election judges not showing up, people afraid to vote, turnout, in-person turnout down, absentee turnout up. I think it's very prudent, if possible, to move the primary, so long as it's done in a way that doesn't disenfranchise voters. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the details matter in terms of, for example, whether people can still register to vote if the primary is going to be delayed, whether people can still request and get absentee ballots. So a lot of it depends on the details. If you can pull it off, I think it does make sense. We don't want people going out unnecessarily during this time. And so if there's a way to keep people's franchise and do things a little later, that makes sense.
And mail-in ballots, Gloria, do you see that as central to ensuring that the public has confidence in the system?
I think mail-in ballots should have been in place before, but here's a concern I have, and that's access to the mail-in ballots. How are people going to receive them? How do they know they even exist? Are we going to have public attention given to mail-in ballots, commercials on television and radio? And then I was listening earlier about the deadline. Mm-hmm. People need to be assured that their ballots are going to be counted. And many times people don't vote absentee because they feel their ballot is only counted when there is a dispute of some kind. And so having these ballots come in, that means a delay in the time. If it's going to be coming in on the day of the election, there's a delay when they'll be counted. So that security, I think, is something people may feel is not there, and they would want to have more security when it comes to their mail-in ballots, how to get them in and when they'll be counted.
And Gloria, how to get the word out, and who should be that person? Who is that trusted person who can talk to the public that way?
I think it's going to have to be, as you said before, the Secretary of State for the state. I think it should be the president. It should be, people who were normally in positions of concern, the governor and others, that their state's electoral process runs smoothly and they're confident. So elected officials are going to have to take the role of leadership in making sure that people know, and that private businesses and others like this station and other groups with broadcasting ability actually are able to get the word out through their constituencies.
Rick, one of the subtitles of one of the words in the subtitle to your book is distrust. Even before the crisis that we're dealing with now, what is at the root of that distrust of our electoral system?
Yeah, so in my book, Election Meltdown, which was obviously written before the coronavirus crisis.
Yeah, different kind of meltdown, right?
Yes. Well, same kind of meltdown, but for a different reason. The question is, will the losers of the election, which will be 47-48% of the population at least, accept the results as legitimate and say, we'll just go on and fight another day? And so in the book, I talk about four factors that have led to this increasing mistrust of the fairness of the vote count and the legitimacy of the process. One of those is Republican legislatures passing laws that have made it harder to vote and to register to vote in the name of preventing voter fraud. And these laws don't actually prevent the little amount of voter fraud that we do have. And so this voter fraud, voter suppression fight convinces both sides that the other side is trying to cheat. The second problem are pockets of election administrator incompetence. And we see this in places like Broward County, Florida, or the way the Secretary of State of Georgia, Brian Kemp, then Secretary of State, now governor, ran his election and wins a very close election. We focus on those really bad actors, not the 95% plus of election administrators who do a good job. The third problem is dirty tricks like what we saw the Russians do, or the absentee ballot tampering that occurred in the 2018 North Carolina congressional race. And the last factor that I think increases this mistrust is an increasingly incendiary rhetoric about stolen or rigged elections. You know, it's Donald Trump, but it's not just Donald Trump. For example, it was Sherrod Brown when Stacey Abrams lost her governor's race in Georgia, the talk of the election was stolen. And so you put these factors together, even before coronavirus, there's a lot of mistrust and a lot of concern that the election is not going to be accepted as valid by those who are on the losing side of it come 2020.
Gloria, do you see it that way?
Well, I see also the fact that from the time period of the end of slavery in 1865 and the grant of voting rights to black men in 1870, and this happens to be the 150th anniversary of the 15th Amendment in 1870, giving black men the right to vote, as well as the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, giving women the right to vote. And there have been so many voter suppression tactics put in place since that time to undermine the power of the black vote. That was already in place before. And so now we're seeing those tactics then continue to undermine what will be the access to the vote of black voters. The black vote is pivotal in a national election. In local elections, not as much, but in the national election, it's pivotal. And so my concern is when it comes to understanding that access through the mail-in ballots. Do we have the addresses correct? We have a case, H. Philip Randolph in Hempstead in Ohio, once again, where they said that, if you don't have the correct address, and if you didn't get the mail-in card, and you didn't send it back, then you're not on the rolls. So we will know how people who are not on the voting rolls actually access the government offices to make sure that they are on the rolls. There's so much that we don't have access to right now. So those people who were marginalized before will feel marginalized again. And then you may have protests. You may, and then how do protests look in this time period of social distancing? How do the voices of the people get access to the government to let them know that they are being marginalized during this election cycle? And I also am very concerned about people who are running for office. We only see the incumbents on television, Democrat and Republican. Mm. So we don't have a really fair system. We can't have rallies. So how do we actually have a competitive system in which somebody running to for an office to displace the incumbent has a fair access to the constituents, to the electorate body, so that they can find out all the different issues and can vote as an informed voter?
Let me go back to you, Rick, and just picking up at something that both you and Gloria said, but I wonder that so while the focus of the public, our elected officials, and the media are focused on this pandemic, that allows for shenanigans when no one is paying attention.
Well, right. And so, you know, one worry related to the virus would be, you know, people putting out false statements to try to dissuade people from coming to polling places. This is something I'm very worried about. You know, we've already seen dirty tricks in the past where, you know, people try and give misinformation about where, when, and how to vote. And so I think that, you know, it's very easy to imagine a situation where bad actors try to give wrong information about what's, you know, in the public health in terms of voting, whether elections are being canceled, things that would normally not be accepted as valid by lots of people under these crisis circumstances could be. And so it's really important that media and social media companies provide ways for voters to get accurate information. I think, you know, all election officials like secretaries of state and county election officials, they should be verified by Twitter or other social media platforms so that they can make sure that their accurate information is the one that is, you know, at the top of people's news feeds so that they know what they actually can and can't do related to the election.
You know, as I was preparing for this, I scribbled down the word self-disenfranchisement. And Gloria, I just also am concerned that people are just so worried about their health, the health of their neighbors and their loved ones, that they will stay home or feel that they don't either have the time or energy to vote. And that will really depress the vote looking ahead.
And that's state, local, and federal voting. And that's what we need to understand. So much focus has been placed on the national election, as it should be, because the issues are stark there. But we have to look at these local elections as well and how important they are to the resources that are given to communities. My concern, as I said before, were voter suppression tactics that were put in place before this virus, such as the photo ID. So now we have a photo ID issue that becomes even worse because people cannot access the government offices in order to get these photo IDs necessary to register to vote. How will the photo ID issue then play a part in being able to register? How is registration taking place? And my other last concern going into this fear of actually voting is, once again, how do you get the information to everyone that the primaries have changed, that the voting place has changed? If we're going to be 6 feet apart, are the voting times going to be expanded because it's going to take even longer to get things done? I used to be a poll worker when I was younger, and I do know most poll workers are older, but my concern is now, how do you hire the poll workers? How do they know that these jobs are open and have the time to come in to do the training? Is the training online? Does everyone have a computer to access this training? There are a lot of questions regarding access that concern me.
Let me pick up on the photo ID thing, because Pennsylvania attempted to have photo ID and it was shot down by the state Supreme Court. To you, Rick, how many states still require photo ID to vote?
I don't have the figures off the top of my head. Every state requires some form of ID. It might be a signature. Right. Some states don't require a photo ID. There are more than a dozen states that have strict voter identification requirements now. And, you know, one of the things we saw just last week was that Kentucky adopted a new strict voter ID requirement, even as the legislature was meeting during the time of the virus, and even as it was clear that what we really need now is an expansion of absentee balloting so that people who are afraid or unable to get to the polling place will be able to vote. I do think what we're going to see is an increase in lawsuits over these requirements because they're just going to be impossible to meet. In my book, Election Meltdown, I talk about how the amount of election litigation has nearly tripled in the period over the last 20 years and the period since the Supreme Court decided Bush versus Gore and ended the presidential election contest in the year 2000. We're going to see a lot of litigation over virus-related issues to the extent that it is still affecting what we're able to do in November. And I think courts are going to have to deal with a very difficult balancing act. On the one hand, you want to stick with the rules that you have in place beforehand so that it doesn't look like you're trying to benefit one party or the other. But on the other hand, we're dealing with really extraordinary circumstances. And, you know, certain kinds of rules that might seem that they, you know, make perfect sense under normal circumstances may be quite onerous for voters. For example, in the 11 states that don't have online voter registration, if you're supposed to get a form from a government office and that government office is closed, you might not be able to register. So what are the rules going to be? And just yesterday we saw a lawsuit filed in Georgia involving third-party candidates and independent candidates who need to collect signatures to get on the ballot. What are we going to do about those candidates if they can't go door-to-door because it's not safe to collect signatures? And so we're going to have to deal with all kinds of things that we normally wouldn't be thinking about if, you know, social contact were at its regular levels.
Well, let me pick up on all of that, and we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Rick Hassan. He's a professor of law and political science at the University of California at Irvine. His new book is Election Meltdown, Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Gloria Brown Marshall, professor of constitutional law at John Jay College. Her book is The Voting Rights War, the NAACP, and the Ongoing Struggle for Justice. We're talking about voting and voting rights during the pandemic. Radio Times at WHYY.org. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Rick Hassan and Gloria Brown Marshall about the fact that a number of states, including Pennsylvania, have postponed their primaries. As we know, campaign rallies and town halls have been put on hold. We're talking about how do you hold an election and have every vote count in the middle of a pandemic. And again, you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, and we'll be sure to get you part of the conversation. Gloria, let me pick up on something, and Rick writes about this in his book and has referenced the fact that come the general election, it's important that those votes be counted and be seen as correct so that we know that the loser, who the loser is, and that they leave office. Are you concerned about that?
Well, I was concerned about this before because Donald Trump has said that he doesn't plan on going down easily. If he loses, he's going to have to lose by a landslide, and I think that's going to be difficult. Also, my concern is, once again, for those marginalized voters, the black vote has always been an important and powerful part of the national election scene. And at this point, we have issues as to whether or not, as we saw in Georgia, the tactics that are being put in place by state legislative bodies and places in the South and other places, and especially pivotal swing states, are going to undermine the black vote and other voters that are in a place where they can change the outcome of the election. And given the fact, as Rick has pointed out, that some states to this very point of the pandemic are still putting in place obstacles to prevent people from accessing registration, accessing the photo ID they need, putting other obstacles in place to make it more difficult to exercise this right to vote that we as citizens.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I think that's going to not just be at the end that people believe that if Donald Trump wins a second term that it's legitimate and undermine our democracy, but I think it's also going to be for those people who are trying to vote and have had these problems in the past really fall away from our government with the belief that there is no time in which they have a legitimate right to vote and have access to the polls the way they should as full citizens.
Well, Rick, let me pick up on that. And let's say in November 2020, and I've gotten emails about this and worries, frankly, from our listeners. If, let's say, President Trump does lose the election, that's, of course, a big if, and does not concede the election, what is the remedy? What happens next?
Sure. Well, first of all, I should say that a concession has no legal effect. I mean, it has a big political effect. Usually the supporters of the candidate also agree that, you know, the election is over. What really matters is the counting of the Electoral College votes in Congress, assuming we're not so disrupted that we don't have a Congress that is assembled. Assuming that we count the Electoral College votes, then there would be a winner declared. And if that winner is not Donald Trump, then presumably he would, be declared the loser, that the Congress would follow the actual results of the Electoral College votes, and then he would leave office. Would he not voluntarily leave? Would this involve the military? I've heard all kinds of concerns that people have, but, you know, I think a lot of that is speculation, and I agree with Gloria that if it's a decisive loss, then it becomes much less plausible to claim that you have a right to remain in office. Here's something I'm much more concerned about, and it ties into Pennsylvania, which is that now that Pennsylvania has moved to no-excuse absentee balloting, I expect, with or without virus concerns, but especially with virus concerns, we're going to have a flood of new absentee ballots, they take a really long time to process, especially in large cities. So think Philadelphia, which has a history of not great election administration. So you can imagine that President Trump is ahead on election night in Pennsylvania. But yet 5 days later, after Philadelphia is done counting, Joe Biden takes the lead, and he's actually found to be the winner. Well, then you can imagine Trump appealing to the state legislature to send in a separate slate of electors, choosing him as the Electoral College winner. And there's a whole convoluted thing that's supposed to happen in Congress when that happens. But you can imagine all kinds of questions about the legitimacy of the election if there are two different slates of electors coming out of Pennsylvania. And wow. If Trump is ahead on election night and then 5 days later, the opponent is ahead. So, I mean, that's where I think it gets really messy and uncomfortable. Not that Trump loses and fails to concede, but that Trump claims that he's won the election when, in fact, it appears that his opponent has gotten more votes.
I mean, Gloria, that reminds me of a version of what happened in Florida in 2000, which, of course, went to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, and I happened to be visiting in Florida during that time period, and it was very ugly. And there were protests, and this goes back to my previous point. How do the people then let their voices be heard in a situation like that? And hopefully this pandemic will be over, but leading into it with social distancing, how do we tell our government our displeasure with the way the voting has gone, or the campaigning, or their lack of access to information, their mail-in ballots? There's so much that has to happen in order for us to get to November, and the people feel satisfied. We also don't want the very vocal Trump supporters feeling that their leader has been cheated out of the presidency for a second term.
Sure.
And then we have riots in the streets over this. That's been a concern that people have voiced as well. But there's also this voice of the people who have been disenfranchised before and know that there are always these tricks that take place with every election, especially those elections where different ideological viewpoints are crashing and we don't have someone who can speak for them in a time period of the pandemic. So hopefully there will be a time in which those voices can be heard in a form of some kind and be heard by other people as well as, and not just in social media, but where can these voices be heard in news and in other places. I'm hoping that stations like yours and others will actually tap to the pulse of what the people are feeling and concerned about out there when this election gets closer.
No doubt. And we are doing the best that we can under all these various circumstances. Rick, let me go back to you and hearing both you and Gloria talk. Is this an argument? It's not going to happen in November by November 2020, but an argument for nationalizing elections. Is there a good reason to at least think about that or maybe even do that?
Well, right. So I think that, you know, my focus in the book Election Meltdown, and also as part of an ad hoc group that next month is going to release some recommendations, has been on 2020. What can we do to ensure that the 2020 election goes smoothly? And I think we're not going to nationalize our elections. We already saw that Congress did not act on a proposal the Democrats had put forward to have require every state to offer, as Pennsylvania now does, no excuse a vote by mail. So we're not getting any major changes in how our elections are run in the short term. In the long run, I would like the United States to join with other advanced democracies around the world. Think Canada, Germany, UK, Australia, and have national nonpartisan election administration for national elections. But we should have the same rules for conducting our national elections across the country, the same ballot machinery. I think, you know, there's lots of reasons to have variation. You know, the great federal experiment of the United States offers a lot of wonderful things. But what happens with election administration is you have inconsistencies. You have smaller jurisdictions that are just overwhelmed with problems, also some larger jurisdictions. It would be good to have uniformity in vote counting rules, uniformity in how people can vote, how people can register to vote. I think that would be a good way forward in the long term.
Do you agree, Gloria?
I do. I'm also concerned that our U.S. Attorney General, who has the power as our top prosecutor, has been so silent when it comes to voting rights issues. And that's where we normally look to that federal civil rights division to actually protect the rights of the individual voter. And William Barr has instead had a press conference in which he's asking Congress to pass laws to restrict constitutional rights even more during this pandemic and extend that restriction past the pandemic into any civil disobedience or natural disaster that may take place. So we're at a loggerhead when it comes to, are we going to do more modern things entering into this 21st century of voting rights? Right now, we're still doing a lot of 20th century voting. And I think that this pandemic is really bringing that to the fore.
It's just so strange, both to you and Rick, to Gloria. I mean, and we invented representative government, and yet here we are in 2020 trying to figure out how, obviously that we're under a crisis here with a pandemic, but nonetheless, how to make our electoral system work. And I wonder, too, whether just voter registration at the age of 18. I know, Rick, that's something that you and others have called for.
Well, you know, you're pointing to the age of our democracy as a reason why we would be the most advanced. But in some ways, it's the reason we're the least advanced, because, you know, if you look at countries that have more recent constitutions, they've taken these things into account. We didn't have political parties as we now understand them at the time of the Constitution. Right. We didn't have, the same kinds of rules in terms of ballot access. And remember, at the time the Constitution was created, you couldn't vote for a United States Senate. Senators were chosen by the state legislatures. You didn't vote for president. You know, the state legislatures chose the electors. And so we need a modern system, but we have 200 plus years of hyper decentralized partisan election administration. Of course, it would make sense that as it's done in just about every other country, when you turn 18, you're automatically registered to vote. I support national universal voter registration with a national voter identification card, something which both Democrats and Republicans don't like. You know, they don't like different aspects of it. But I think this is the way it works in most other countries. And I think we should have a system that is rational so that you're registered when you become eligible and you stay registered for the rest of your life. And, you know, again, we're thinking long term. None of these things are going to happen in time for November.
I have to say both Rick and you, Gloria, have painted a rather bleak picture of our democracy, of our system of electing officials. Is there something that we do right that is an example to the rest of the world?
Well, I have to say that during the time period in which we had a fully functioning Voting Rights Act, it was really something that was prescient from 1965, that there would be attempts to undermine the rights of the voters of African descent and others. And having that gutted was a fall backward. And we need to pass legislation that reinstates the preclearance clause of the Voting Rights Act. But that was something that we did right. It was understood that you have to protect minority voters. I think the other thing that we've done right is that we have tried to open our elections to many different voices, but unfortunately we all don't give all the voices platforms. And that's coming to the fore right now. We don't have the platforms available for opponent voices in this national and even the local elections. So hopefully with all the broadcasting we have, that we'll be able to open those broadcast venues up to all the different voices who are running for office.
Rick, really, though, up until I've sort of lost track of time, I think a lot of people have as well, but the last election that we had in March and even Super Tuesday, we did see a lot of voter turnout. I mean, I think that should give us some degree of optimism that there is engagement.
Well, you know, before the coronavirus hit the United States, we were talking about record turnout. Now, is that a sign of a healthy democracy? You know, in one way, of course, we want turnout up because we want people to be able to express themselves. But another way, it shows how polarized our society is right now. So why is turnout up? Because people either love or hate Donald Trump, and they want to come out and they want to, you know, it's kind of going to be a referendum on Trump. And so sometimes, at least in the United States, which has generally low voter turnout, high voter turnout means that there's a lot of polarization in our society. I'm concerned, though, that there are going to be people who are going to want to vote, but because of this virus are going to have more difficulty registering or voting. And so now we're about 7 months before the election, and we need to think about this before we know who the winners and losers are, before we know which state might be a hot spot and might have trouble getting people to polling, physical polling places. What can we do to ensure that as many people as possible are able to register and to vote? That really should be the national focus, and that should be the focus whether you love Donald Trump or you hate Donald Trump. It should be about how do we maximize the ability of people to be able to express their viewpoint in November.
And briefly, how would we make that happen if that's the number one priority?
Well, so I would start with national no-excuse vote by mail. Every state should be making it easier. We should expand online voter registration. 39 states have it, including many Republican states. It's not a Democratic or Republican thing. And we need to have outreach publicity about how people are going to be able to vote in the time of pandemic. We're going to need a lot more funding so that people can actually afford, so that states and local governments can actually afford to run physical polling places in ways that are consistent with the health requirements of our times.
And how about for you, Gloria? Go ahead.
Yeah, but we also know that all those things then assist people who are going to vote Democratic. And unfortunately, that's why a lot of them are not going to happen. And that's the way in which politics works. You're not going to assist your opponent to get their constituents to the polls. And that's also a part of dirty politics, but that's modern politics and probably very old as well.
I wonder, though, Gloria, there are obviously no rallies scheduled, no town halls. Is that a detriment to democracy?
I think so. We need to hear our political incumbents, not just the ones who are speaking. They have all the television time. They have their voices heard. And they're the only ones that are becoming familiar to the constituents who are out there, the possible voters. Where are the opposition parties? Mm. Where are the people who should have access to the media as well? And under these very strenuous times, we have to figure out ways in which we can hear the platforms of the other people who are running for office, who want change. And if we don't have those platforms in state, local, as well as federal elections, then it's not the true democracy I think this country thinks it has.
Well, we have to leave it there. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Gloria Brown Marshall, thanks for joining us. Thanks for being our guest.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Rick Hassan, thank you for joining us as well.
Always a pleasure.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.